Hi, I'm Dave Reinerson. Welcome to The Marvels of Science, a podcast about the science and tech of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All your favorite heroes and villains, from Black Panther and Spider-Man to Drax and the Falcon. Speaking of these snapped heroes, today's topic is Thanos' snap. Here with me to discuss the enormous ecological impact of the snap is Tara Stewart Merrill, our science expert today. Tara has a PhD in ecology, evolution, and conservation biology from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and is a Simons Foundation Fellow with the Life Sciences Research Foundation, conducting a postdoc at the University of Colorado Boulder. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And our color commentator is Janet Rankin, an architect and a friend of mine right here in DC. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Janet.
Thanks for having me.
Janet, first of all, how's your science education been? Did you do well in science at school?
Did I do well? Yes, I did, but it was a very, very long, long time ago.
It doesn't feature too much in your career.
Architects are more on the tech side and a little bit less on the science side.
And how many movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe have you seen?
Six? Seven?
Okay. And Janet?
I'm going to go with 0.25.
You were telling me before that in your prep for this episode, you watched the last part of Avengers Infinity War.
I watched the first and the last, and then I relegated myself to reading about it because I needed a little more information than I was getting.
Yeah, it's hard to jump into the 22nd movie in the series. 21st, 22nd, whatever it is. That's jumping in a little bit in the deep end. It also, though, gives me an excuse to give the background for this episode in far greater detail than I usually get. So the big bad guy is Thanos. He has an awful lot of trauma to process, but since that's too much work, see episode 11 of this podcast on PTSD, he has gone around the galaxy collecting these six gems called Infinity Stones. He sets these stones in a very special gauntlet, snaps his fingers, and finally accomplishes the goal that he set for himself years and years ago: destroy half of all life in the universe. So, Janet, are you a goal-setting kind of person? Like, have you ever made a 5 or 10 year plan and stuck to it?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes. You know, we live here in Washington, which I think is really different environment than you might see in a science-based environment. But here in Washington, people are very, very goal-oriented, and it's usually through the career. So I want to run a project. I want to run 10 projects. I want to meet these 10 people. And so the goals that I think I've accomplished have come a lot in that professional arena.
Have you ever debated ending half of all life in the universe or nah?
You know, I've always been pretty fond of living things.
That's nice. Thanos has also made his 5 or 10 year plan or whatever it is. He's committed himself sort of single-mindedly to this goal and has followed through in an instant, or well, an instant that lasts long enough for some poignant goodbyes for the unlucky half of the heroes.
I don't feel so good. I don't know what's happening. I don't want to go. I don't want to go.
Half of all life in the universe turns to ash. If you're a 14-year-old girl or a certain overly invested 35-year-old man, it is a heartbreaking moment. And the next time we see the surviving members of the Avengers in Avengers Endgame, Natasha, the Black Widow, tells us he did exactly what he said he was going to do. Thanos wiped out 50% of all living creatures.
I don't buy it.
Oh, why is that?
Oh, so many reasons. I've been thinking a lot about logistically, could you wipe out half of all living things? I don't think it's possible. Based on symbionts and parasites, because of how they're distributed among their hosts, I think if you kill off half of all free living things, some of the things that live on those organisms, you're going to kill off more than half, and others you're going to kill off less than half. So if you start looking at the little things, the bacteria, the parasites, the lice, and the mites living on birds, there's no way you can precisely kill off half of them.
Yeah, the tricky part is we're dealing with what's essentially magic.
Yeah.
Like these stones are sort of omnipotence granting devices. So it's tricky to figure out even if who's deciding which half. Is it random? Do the stones,
exactly.
Is there a six-sided die inside one of the stones? Or is one of them doing the thinking and deciding, well, no, if I do this, it's not exactly 50%. And the order I got from the guy holding the thing is 50%. So what I need to do is this careful. Like, is there a computer? Is there a system inside doing it? Or is it just totally random and then winds up probably being, like you said, way more than 50% because you've killed off parasites and hosts indiscriminately?
Yeah. And I think even with a perfect mathematical algorithm, I think it wouldn't work out. The magic. Magic and math are at odds.
Also, when they talked about it before, it seemed like Thanos was going to wipe out half of all humans, or I guess, and all the sentient species on all the planets and all the galaxies. But it turns out he wiped out half of all animal life. At least that's what creatures mean to me.
I was interested in the idea that living didn't mean trees. It didn't mean plants.
Yeah, I think if his stated goal was to relieve the pressure of overpopulation, provide more resources, which is just a terrible way to go about it for 85 different reasons. But yeah, I guess if he destroys all the crops, then that's not helping his goal either.
Yeah, that was one of my main issues. I was like, okay, so, you know, say I live on a small farm and I have 4 kids and 2 cows and 2 chickens and some crops. This is obviously wrong. I'm not going to do this. But if I kill off half of my children and then kill off 1 cow and 1 chicken, I don't think I've really solved anything. Right? Because it's the same number of resources per consumer.
True. Yeah. It's sort of forcing everyone into a vegetarian lifestyle, or at least temporarily until they can find some other cows to breed. But let's try to break this down a bit. Janet, before we get too deep into this, I'd like you to answer an impossible question. Can you please define life for us?
So in a non-scientific manner, I would say life are things that can change. You know, a person can grow, a tree can grow, bacteria can multiply, you know, a virus can spread. So in my mind, life are things that are animate and that they can evolve in some fashion.
I think you hit on a lot of the things that are some of the hallmarks, the attributes we try to assign to life, things like evolution, adaptation, reproduction, things like that. So what I'm trying to do here is sort of break down this hugely, enormously gigantic event into some bite-sized pieces. So Tara, do we have a robust definition for life, or is it just sort of a know it when you see it sort of thing?
It's a really good question. And I think one of the best definitions that I've come across for life is something that's able to make a copy of itself. So it's not something that can make copies, right? Because a copy machine, it makes copies of paper, but it doesn't reproduce new copy machines. But something that life exclusively can do is create copies of itself. And I think one of the problems with defining life is that we like to think that things are dichotomous and fit into nice boxes, that things are black and white. Mm-hmm. But if life ultimately came from non-randomly assembling matter that once was inorganic and ultimately became organic, that means that there could be a bit of a continuum between what is not life and what is life. And so once you have that continuum, you kind of have a gray area for what can't be defined as either. And I think a lot of scientists struggle with placing viruses in that context or things like prions, because they're things that can't create copies of themselves on their own. You can't just have a virus, in most cases, replicating on its own in the environment. It needs to use our genetic machinery to do that. But it clearly also has some attributes of life associated with it.
Yeah, we're all sort of obsessed with one particular virus these last 15 months or so. I was going to ask you, if viruses are creatures, then, from the movies, the only word we have to hang our hat on really is creatures. Thanos keeps just saying life, but he clearly doesn't mean all living things because, as we said, we don't want to get rid of all the crops. Is a virus a creature? I don't know what a creature is. Every definition I found of creature is an animal. It just says it's a synonym for animal, basically. I don't know.
Yeah, and that gets tricky. I mean, because not everything falls into the category of plant or animal. Mm-hmm. We have things like fungi. What are they? I would think about the virus in terms of what it's doing ecologically. So a virus acts kind of like a predator in some way because it can kill off its host. And in killing off its host, it can replicate and spread, just like a predator by eating its prey can grow and reproduce and have offspring that also allow the predator's population to grow. So I definitely think of viruses as life. Whether they fit into our definition of creature, which is kind of muddy, I would call them creatures, but I might be alone in that.
I think we have a little wiggle room here because we don't really need to figure out if viruses are alive or are creatures, just if Thanos thought they counted. So for no particular reason, I'm going to say he thought they did. Okay. Half of them are gone too. Did I just simplify things or make things so much worse. What is, I guess, do viruses have an ecological role to play, or are they just an annoyance to people?
Viruses definitely have an ecological role to play. When we think about how ecosystems function, or food webs, which are just feeding associations between all species within a system, we think that those feeding associations can help support some species, but they also can help suppress some species. So viruses tend to be at the very highest trophic levels of a food web, meaning that nothing is really eating the viruses, but the viruses are eating the species that we would say are at the top of the food chain. So while humans, we can think of ourselves as being at the top of the food chain or in a higher trophic level in a food web, we have viruses that eat us, and those viruses are even higher than us. And when those viruses either decrease our birth rates or increase our death rates, they have the capacity to kind of control our population to the same extent that something like a predator can control its prey population. So viruses, pathogenic bacteria, just parasites and pathogens broadly can have really important effects on the organisms that they infect.
Fascinating. Okay. Let's look a little bit bigger. The first concept that springs to mind when I think about ecology is the food chain. Usually, as you said. Janet, can you reach back to school days and recall what the food chain is?
I think that, you know, if we're to be on the top of the food chain, we are eating things that then eat smaller things that then might eat another living thing that then might eat a microscopic thing. So it's a chain where each one grows to support the other.
That matches exactly what I remember from, you know, seventh grade or whatever we first learned about the food chain. Do you remember what the food web is? I will be honest, and I had to Google the food chain versus food web. And then when I saw it, I was like, oh, yeah, that was like probably, you know, eighth grade instead of seventh. But do you remember what the food web is?
I would have to admit that I have never heard that term before.
Tara, can you help us out? Are those definitions from like middle school pretty much right? Or
yeah, so the food chain, the way that we introduce the concept to students that energy flows from things like plants up to higher levels, things like predators at the top. But it's an oversimplification because it kind of assumes that things are linear and they move from the bottom up. But really, if you go out into an ecosystem, you can kind of visualize it, that each species is like a ball in space. You can connect a species to other species or balls with lines based on who eats who. And it's not this simple linear thing. It's this really complicated web where an organism that eats plants could also eat another organism that also eats plants. And so then that gets a little complicated, right? So a food web is just, it's a realization of all of the feeding links of all species in a system. And instead of it being a nice straight line, it tends to take on a big web-like appearance.
You have 576 possible web shooter combinations.
So the concept of the food web has sort of replaced the concept of the food chain.
Yeah.
Well, I think what I learned in school was that a food web is actually made up of food chains, but that isn't really right either. That still just implies a bunch of linear relationships that aren't really there.
Yeah, I mean, you could kind of see it as a bunch of food chains linked together. But I think what's problematic with the food chain view is that it's only unidirectional. And this is where some of the parasites I study get really exciting, because they have multiple life stages that infect different hosts. So they start out in a snail, and then they move to an amphibian, and then they move to a bird. And then when the bird poops, the snail eats the bird poop and gets infected with the parasite eggs, and the life cycle starts over again. So in that sequence of events, this parasite is at the very top of the food chain because it's eating the bird, right? But when the parasite is in a free living stage, moving from the snail to the fish, an insect can come along and eat that parasite. So at the same time, the parasite is towards the bottom of the food chain. So you can have this one species that occupies both the top of the food chain and the bottom of the food chain at the same time. And that's where food webs get a little bit complicated.
So at the same time that parasite might be eaten by a thing that its prey, a frog, let's say, eats.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's very confusing. Okay. Speaking of bugs, returning listeners will know that I do not like bugs. I get pretty easily wigged out. Check out episode 6, Ants, 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 for a lot of examples of that. But I have heard they're, you know, pretty important in maintaining the entire global ecosystem. So, Janet, how do you feel about bugs? Where are you on the bug issue?
Well, now that we've talked about the web, I think it's a great context to explain how I might feel about bugs.
Okay.
I personally have no interest in interacting with any bugs. I realize in great detail that each one has their place in this big web, and that without them, we're in big trouble.
It reminds me a bit of, I'll just say scared of bees, but I don't want to kill them all because of, all those crops that I like to eat. And also, it's not my place to destroy a species. I'm not Thanos. There's a sticker. That's some merch for the podcast. I'm not Thanos.
You're supposed to say, no, of course you're not.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for jumping in. But sometimes I think about, if we can isolate the species of mosquito, for instance, that carry things like Zika and malaria and dengue, and if we can say, it's them or us at this point. Millions of people every year die of malaria. If we can figure this out the right way, we can take them out. But the enormous ecological impacts of playing with a web that we don't fully understand, because Tara, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming we don't have the entire food web of the planet mapped out.
No, we don't.
So ecology is still a growing field, right?
Yes,
haven't finished it yet, right?
We have many food webs for very particular ecosystems, a lake food web or a salt marsh food web. But even those are still missing a lot of species. And part of the study of food webs involves asking, how resilient is this food web to any perturbation? So if we took out this species, would the food web collapse or would it be stable? If we took out 40% of species, what would happen to the food web? And I think we really need to know the answers to those questions before we could do something like completely eradicate a mosquito that transmits malaria or dengue or Zika.
Yeah, it feels like, a lesson we might have learned from Avengers Age of Ultron, where Tony and Bruce mess with things they don't fully understand and almost destroy the world.
I don't want to hear the man was not meant to meddle medley.
All kinds of lessons we can learn from the Avengers. I'm interested in some of the initial impacts of half of all animal life disappearing. We should probably confine our discussion to Earth, because I don't think any of us knows anything about life on other planets. If you do, let's talk about that instead, because you're probably going to win a Nobel Prize soon. So, anybody? Life on other planets?
I wish. It's my dream.
I've been thinking about how fast larger animals breed versus smaller animals. Janet, what are your feelings on rats? We live in DC, a city with a few rats. Not like New York sized or New York number of them, but there's a bunch. How do you feel about rats?
Whereas I personally would not like to run across a rat, and they don't seem to enhance my personal life in any way. Again, I feel like the mosquito, like the bee, that they fit into a slot in the big picture. And, it's kind of not up to me to get rid of them.
Hashtag I'm not Thanos.
It's more like what you were saying. We just don't know what's going to happen, right? And not only do we not know what's going to happen with the set of parameters that we have today, but obviously things are evolving. If things weren't evolving, we wouldn't be talking about climate change. So what was true 500 years ago is not the same as what was true 1,000 years ago or 500 years from now, because our whole system is just constantly evolving.
That's a great point. Tara, what about the effort to understand today's ecosystem and its relation to the ecosystem from 1,000 years from now or 1,000 years ago? Is that part of your general study?
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in how a lot of ongoing human-caused changes to our environments are ultimately affecting species. And because I'm mostly interested in infectious disease, I think a lot about how things like climate change and drought might be affecting the transmission of parasites and pathogens throughout entire ecological systems. Going back to this question of what does our world look like today compared to 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, and how might that influence what would happen if we halved all of life? I think one of the big issues is that today we're already seeing kind of the most profound levels of extinction that we've seen throughout all of human history.
We're in the sixth great mass extinction, isn't that right?
That is absolutely correct.
He didn't say dead, he said extinct.
And what that means is that a lot of species are currently on the decline, and they're already threatened and close to going extinct. So all of those species, if you have their populations, it's almost certain that they will go extinct. And I think that's yet another flaw in Thanos' plan, is that by having all of these threatened and endangered species, he's not allowing them to go to 50%. He's actually forcing them to go to zero.
Because if there are 100 individuals that were barely surviving, now there are 50, and they're definitely not going to survive.
Exactly. Because if you have something so close to the brink already, and then you cut its population size by half, we think that stochastic events, so just kind of random events, could lead many of those remaining individuals to die. The population just can't sustain itself, and we lose the whole species.
His plan seems not very well thought out.
He seemed to be thinking only of the, you know, if you want to call them the top of the chain or the predator, he seemed to be only thinking of the living things that consume what he thought of as resources, as opposed to the living things that actually were resources.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. We do get some actual evidence, too, that it's not just the humans and the other sentient species talking trees and so on, but even down to insects, because when, spoiler, Janet, they fix it and life starts coming back, right after Hulk's snap that brings everybody back, Scott Lang, Ant-Man, is sort of fascinated by a butterfly that flies up to him. And it's implied the butterfly just poofed back into existence, meaning all the way down the food chains, two butterflies have been knocked out. What would be the impact of half of all pollinators being destroyed in an instant? That's a terror question for sure. Don't worry, Janet.
Ooh, yeah.
It would be bad.
It would be really bad.
Okay, next question.
Especially if we don't kill off half of all crops. And if we did, that would be bad too. But I think if we wiped out half of all pollinators, getting those crops to reproduce would be really problematic for crops that are pollinator dependent.
I think what I would really like to see from the Marvel Universe is more stories taking place in the intermediate 5 years between the first snap and fixing the snap. It would be sort of awful, I assume, but I'm also fascinated about what the world looked like. So back to rats, though. My general thought was that the larger an animal is, the slower it breeds. Is that roughly true, or am I just making stuff up?
Oh, that's roughly true, for sure.
All right. Just felt right.
Yeah, and I had the same problem. I was like, I don't know about this killing off half of everything thing, because killing off half of like the 500-year-old trees in our forests, it's going to take so long to grow those back. Whereas killing off half of the plankton species I studied, Daphnia, they'll probably rebound in about 3 days.
So like if we're looking at rats and elephants, if half the elephants are gone, they have a gestation period like a year and a half or something, where rats, it's tomorrow where they're back to normal.
Yeah, it's like if I went into my backyard and I chopped down a tree and then cut my lawn. I think I could expect my lawn to be grown back in a pretty fast period of time, but that tree might not grow back in my lifetime.
So I'm assuming we're all overrun with mice and rats and voles and whatever else is small and can breed very quickly. Rabbits, I suppose, are the classic example.
Yeah, I think killing off half of all life would lead to kind of a shift in the type of species that dominate, because you would have rapid recolonization by small-bodied organisms and much slower repopulation by the larger ones.
So before we finally get into the biggest effects, I want to talk about the smallest affected. Janet, if I told you that the sum total weight, the biomass of all humans is give or take 100 million tons, what's your guess about the biomass of all bacterial life on Earth?
Okay, so say that one more time.
Total weight, all humans, add us all up, about give or take 100 million tons. What's your guess about the total mass of all bacterial life?
Well, I'm wanting to say that it's some fraction of it, but the way you're posing the question, I feel that it's large. It must be larger than I would imagine.
It is larger. I'll give you that.
So is it larger than the humans?
Quite a bit. The problem is, this is another impossible question, I'm sorry to say. We don't really know, unless Tara has better information at her fingertips than I could find, well, in, let's be honest, 5 minutes of Googling. The estimates I came across from perfectly reputable sources ranged between 13 and 550 billion tons. There are a lot of factors that go into making these estimates kind of all over the map, but the lowest one was 13 billion tons, where all humans are 100 million. Regardless, I would characterize it as a bunch and or lots. So, Tara, what happens to our ecosystems if half of the bacteria on the planet are wiped out?
I think probably dramatic alterations to our food webs and probably ecosystem collapses. So, you know, one of the things we're learning that's really important that bacteria in our natural systems do is they can help sequester a lot of the carbon that's in our atmosphere and that's problematic for climate change. Mm. This is especially true for like soil-dwelling bacteria in the tundra, for instance. And if you just get rid of half of all of those, you limit the Earth's capacity to deal with excess carbon, which could be really problematic for ongoing climate change. These bacteria, they're associated with plants, which are then associated with primary consumers and upward through the food web. I think one of the big problems that's bugged me a lot with this destruction of half of all life question is that there's no way that life would then repopulate in a way that would get back to ecosystems and species communities as we know them. And I think that's because any relationship between two species, it's not going to be a linear relationship. So like 50 predators feeding off of 100 prey is not the same dynamic as 25 predators feeding off of 50 prey, because dynamics between two species, be they competitors or a predator prey or host parasite or something with a bacterium, these dynamics tend to be really nonlinear and they can take on a variety of different shapes. And so by having everything, we open up these new opportunities for these strange nonlinear dynamics to occur. And it means that a lot of organisms might shift in who they interact with and how they interact with, such that if you cut everything down by half and then allow time, I think ultimately the types of interactions we see are going to be completely different than anything we know, and quite possibly might not support humans.
Ooh, not to be super self-interested, but ooh, okay, we're getting into the big picture here. So Tara, I know this question has been sort of gnawing at you since we first saw this scene. Broadly speaking, what are some of the other large-scale ecological impacts of the snap, destroying half of all the animals?
Yeah, so I think complete alterations to food webs and how they work, some of which might be stable and maintain themselves, but other food webs might totally collapse. And if you have a collapsed food web, whatever resources humans are depending on might no longer be available to humans. I think we would see far more extinctions following this halving than we do even now, because like I said, we've pushed so many species much lower that any weird stochastic changes could just wipe them out. And then I think there would be potentially some really interesting consequences for evolution, because I don't know how like randomly we're killing off species, but having all of life means having, at least having, all of genetic diversity. And so what that means for how the species can evolve, what traits remained, what genetic traits remained present, and what that means for the evolution of the species is all kind of up in the air.
Jana, assuming you were part of the half that survived the snap, what do you think your reaction would be to the snap? Half of everyone in the world turns to ash along with half of all animal life. How do you think you'd react to the new reality, other than, you know, terror?
Yeah, obviously at first you would have terror, you would have sadness, you would have grief. But we've seen throughout history that humans are adaptable to some pretty adverse conditions. So I think, you know, a certain segment of the population would try to rise. But I think we'd soon understand, which may not have been obvious to us, some of the things that Tara's saying is that the rules that we were playing by previously may not apply. You know, it's not linear. It's not following the same rules. And we would have to almost relearn everything that we took to be true if we wanted to survive, at least ecologically, definitely societally.
Tara, everything comes back 5 years later. What happens then? That sounds like it'd be just as bad or worse. I mean,
yes! This is the problem. Okay, a little bit of ecological theory. But if you assume like how one species population grows, we tend to think that it kind of takes an S-shaped trajectory where the species starts out with kind of slow growth and then it has super, super rapid growth. And then as it reaches what we call its carrying capacity or the maximum number that can be sustained, it evens out again and gets flat. So like one thing we know from models for these species population growth models is that if you cut a species population in half, the period of growth on its growth rate that you get to is the fastest period of growth. So if we cut a population in half, we're going to take it down to where it's exhibiting the steepest increase in growth, which means that cutting a population in half will rapidly bring it right back up to where it was before.
Ooh.
Perfectly balanced. This whole thing should be.
And, you know, for something like a really long-lived tree, that could be a couple hundred years. For something like a zooplankton, that could be 3 days. But this doesn't seem like a long-term solution for anything. It seems like a very short-term fix that's ethically problematic and just ultimately not going to result in what Thanos wants it to result in.
And then when Bruce Banner is the one to put the glove back on and say, okay, everybody comes back and snaps his fingers, he does it with some boundaries. What they're not trying to do is undo the last 5 years, not only because there are probably millions of people that have been born in those 5 years, but because, well, it's not fair to all the people that survived, I suppose. They're not trying to rewind time by 5 years. They just bring everybody back safely, presumably. There's nobody like that was snapped while they were in an airplane that's now flying through the stratosphere. But bring everybody back safely right now. For humans, this probably is annoying and it's a problem. And that's what the Falcon and Winter Soldier series is sort of about. But for the animal life, half of all, I don't know, zebras disappeared 5 years ago. The population rebounded to a certain point, and now the other half just shows up again. What are they going to eat?
Yeah, exactly. And I think if it's truly half of all things, then bringing back half of everything shouldn't be a problem. But you're correct that things have reproduced over that time. So you're actually artificially inflating all populations. And I think that just brings about as many complications as the original reduction does, where if you have nonlinear dynamics between different species, they're all gonna... Oh, I'm not allowed to curse on this show. They're all going to be screwed.
Yeah, I don't know how that could possibly be not horrific. Well, job security for ecologists, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, but that's just another problem. If we kill off half of all life, I mean, it's bad. Obviously, this is a very wrong thing. I don't condone this. But if it were done, it is an interesting natural experiment for studying what the ecological consequences are. But the problem is, you've killed off half of the ecologists, so we don't have the brain power to address that question.
Yeah, and half the funding, presumably.
Oh,
and...
yeah.
But I'm thinking that when you said that the just in the natural world, when you take the species down to 50%, that would cause them to even reproduce faster. But when you think about humans, they're going to place some emotion on top of this as well. And I'm thinking about, you know, it's kind of dark, but you think about the Holocaust, there was, you know, a significant population reduction. And then people made a conscious, and are still making, a conscious effort, a deliberate effort to reproduce at a quicker rate to replace those people lost.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we know this is the case when we kind of look at relationships between early childhood mortality and reproduction rates of people all across the world. Those countries that have the highest reproductive rates tend to be those places where there are the highest rates of early childhood mortality. And it's just one of those things, you know, if you can expect that some number of offspring are likely going to pass, you're going to have an investment in greater reproduction and kind of more consistent reproduction to make up for that. I think you're absolutely right that if, sadly, half of all people disappeared, people would compensate with increased reproduction. And I think that could be problematic. If our global population dropped to 50% of what it was, we'd be like, well, great, now there are plenty of resources for everybody. And I think we'd wind up using more resources with less concern for the waste of those resources. And we'd rapidly get back at the stage that we're at right now, where we're concerned about how many resources are available.
Next up, we have a segment in the show called Technically. Janet and I are going to keep quiet for 2 or 3 minutes as Tara gives us some nuance or details on anything related even tangentially to the topic. Tara, you have the floor.
I can say that this episode literally kept me up at night, or in some cases woke me up early in the morning, because I was trying to think about the answers to what are clearly deep and pressing questions. So one, I wanted to know, okay, what functionally is Thanos' intention? Because I think his intention is to restore balance, but I really want to know what Thanos thinks balance means ecologically, and what he thinks he's actually accomplishing ecologically with this crazy intergalactic genocide. Second, a question that I think all of us want to know the answer to, and we've talked about well, is what would actually happen if half of all life disappeared? And I can guarantee that this ultimately would not restore balance as we know it.
It's a simple calculus. This universe is finite, its resources finite. If life is left unchecked, life will cease to exist. It needs correction.
You don't know that!
I'm the only one who knows that.
But would likely result in dramatic alterations and even collapses to some of our ecological systems. But then the question that just bugs me the most is how we could even reduce all life by half. So suspending the issue that this is just ethically wrong, logistically, I've been giving a thought to how this could even be accomplished in the first place. And my thought is that even with magic, we probably couldn't logistically kill off precisely half of all different species. Part of the way I came to this conclusion was from thinking about parasites. So parasites, like I mentioned, have what are known as aggregated distributions, where the majority of parasites tend to be found in a minority of hosts. So if we took an example like tapeworms and people, I think we'd all agree that we don't share our tapeworms evenly. It's not like everybody is just walking around with two tapeworms on average living in their guts. But the reality is that most people have no tapeworms, and a few people have a lot of tapeworms. And we know that this pattern is universal for parasites. Most hosts have few parasites, and a few hosts have really heavy infections. And I think what this means is that if half of one host species is killed off, it could be that some heavily infected individuals were killed off, leading to a really large portion of that parasite's population dying. Alternatively, if some heavily infected individuals were among those to survive, then you'd have more than half of the parasite's population surviving. And so I think once you start considering species beyond the typical creature, things like parasites that are differentially distributed among their hosts, it gets really challenging to randomly remove half of all free-living species and simultaneously remove precisely half of all parasites. So ultimately, I think the mathematics of aggregation just complicate things. But then in just thinking about Thanos more broadly, A, I don't think Thanos was guided by any ecological theory. He didn't talk to an ecologist. I don't think he functionally knew what his long-term goal was. I don't think he knew what the consequences would be, and I'm not even sure that he accomplished his goal. That is, I think he probably killed off half of some species, but I'm not convinced that he came anywhere near the 50% mark for most forms of life.
Awesome. Thank you. Janet, close us out. What are your final snappy thoughts?
So what I'm thinking, and I think this is a terrific discussion, is that he probably was thinking about what he learned in seventh grade about the food chain and didn't take it far enough to think about the web, because it didn't take us very long today to get to the idea of the web and imagine the far-reaching possibilities of the web. And it just seems like he was stuck on the chain and maybe like me never got to the web. And that's why it's, you know, would probably be destined to fail.
I have one final nihilistic addition.
Okay, go for it.
Well, and it comes back to this question of what did Thanos think restoring balance actually means? The fossil record tells us that all species eventually go extinct. There's no species that persists forever. All species will die. I think that means that balance involves extinction and it involves evolution of new forms of life. So I think if Thanos wanted to restore balance, he would just let things be as they are, let species go extinct, and join their buddies in the fossil record.
I want to be clear, as always, that I love these movies. Scientific accuracy is not a necessary component for good storytelling. In fact, sometimes it gets in the way. I want to thank my guests, Janet Rankin and Tara Stewart Merrill, for being on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and cross your fingers there's an episode 17. That's all for this episode. Thanks once again to my guests, Tara Stewart Merrill and Janet Rankin. Their incredible ability to suspend their disbelief and engage these crazy hypotheticals was really impressive. I'm going to ask you a favor during the credits now. Share this podcast with one friend you think would like it. And if you want to go a step further, I'll ask what every small podcast asks to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. If you want to go nuts, support the podcast directly at patreon.com/marvelsofscience. MCU audio clips were taken from Avengers Age of Ultron, Avengers Infinity War, Avengers Endgame, and Spider-Man Homecoming, and all used entirely without permission. The music is a song called On Tiptoe from Purple Planet Music. That song and more royalty-free music can be found at purple-planet.com. Check out more info about each episode and its guests, including upcoming episodes, at davereinersman.com/marvelsofscience. And find me on Twitter at marvelsoscience. Thanks for listening!